This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because our microphones make a virtual Main Street all across the state this time of day. The real ones we love to cross and say hello to each other because we are so friendly and because it's, you know, kind of a nice autumn day. So we're going to talk about nice autumn days and how we should maybe use them to the best advantage while we've got them with the wonderful horticulturist for Main Street, Ron Smith, who joins us live to take your calls. And I'm here with Ashley Thornburg.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Ron.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
And the number to call is 888-755-6377. And Ron, this is a beautiful fall day.
It is, but it's not a good day to rake leaves.
Okay.
Okay. You need those calm days to do that, to get those picked up. So.
Yes. What is it a good day for?
It's a good day to be planting bulbs.
Okay.
If you can go to some of your favorite nurseries, garden centers, big box stores, they have good sales on bulbs for next spring. And the bulbs have already been conditioned to go ahead and flower next spring. They've also gone through a seasonal cold treatment, you know, so they aren't just untouched bulbs. They aren't unweathered bulbs. So if you plant them at the right depth, generally about 3 to 4 times the size of the bulb, or if you're like my wife, you follow the exact rules, and if they say 6 inches down, you get a ruler out and you measure them down 6 inches and 4 inches apart, and so on and so forth. And my lovely wife has planted around 200 bulbs, daffodil bulbs,
wow,
so far this fall. And
how close together?
About a hand width apart.
Okay.
I mean, that's my approximation. Betsy gets out a ruler or something that's about 4 inches apart and gets it measured out very, very carefully. So I'm looking forward to seeing these very dynamic daffodils coming up next spring. They'll be very beautiful, deep yellow flowers.
And what kind of bulbs would we be planting so we wouldn't be making rabbit salad?
Well, those are the bulbs that the rabbits don't seem to like.
And daffodils. They don't like daffodils.
Daffodils, yes. I don't know why they don't, but if you plant tulips, they'll eat them unless you have a rabbit chaser like Ashley admitted just before we went on air. Called
a cat
that likes to chase the rabbits or scares the rabbits away. Anyway,
get one of those.
Yeah, it's very discouraging because you have these tulips you see coming up. You're anticipating the beautiful flowers, and the flowers they see the stem coming up where the flower is going to be born. Bing, they eat it right down.
Oh, it's fresh.
Kill them. Yeah. You want to kill them.
It's like asparagus to a rabbit, I suppose.
Whatever.
The number to call is 888-755-6377, or you can also email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Again, the phone number, 888-755-6377. And, you know, Ron, I was at a store maybe 3 weeks ago that was having a pretty good sale on bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did go ahead and put some in the ground.
Okay.
And always been under the impression that bulbs will start to come up in the spring. And a couple of them, there are little green shoots coming out of it.
The soil was nice and warm. And,
they
have thought they've gone through their winter treatment or their cold treatment already, and now they're going to get a head start on that. Now, what kind of bulbs did you get?
I think it was, I don't know if I'm saying this right, Muscari, M-U-S-C-A-R-I.
Oh, Muscari, yeah.
Muscari,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that, no big deal. They're tough as nails. They can take whatever.
I was just really surprised. I thought, did I read this entire package?
They're just anxious to try to please you, Ashley, that's all.
Well, I do appreciate that.
Again, the number to call is 888-755-6377, and the horticulturist is in for the first half of our show today, so if you've got a question, make that call now, and if you are, by any chance, listening to the rebroadcast at 7, don't call. Listen, though, don't call. Okay, we have a question here from email. I have a couple of questions related to fall lawn preparation. Mm-hmm. I have some large areas of crabgrass in my lawn, so I'm wondering how I can get rid of it before winter hits. Should I apply Roundup on the plants and then reseed? Is there an easier way to deal with crabgrass? I don't have a sprinkler system. I've neglected my lawn when it comes to watering. The grass in my backyard is very dry. It's tan in color and thin in coverage. What do I need to do in this area to prepare for winter?
Well, the best thing, the crabgrass is flowering now or setting its seed. It's probably started setting its seed some time ago. And the best thing that she can do is to pick up the bag the clippings, and that'll take care of some of that seed. Next spring, as the lilacs are just starting to come into bloom in her neighborhood, in her immediate area, get a pre-emergent annual grass killer, crabgrass killer, and that'll take care of the crabgrass coming up. And then let's assume that she does it, say, April 15th, just for
easy day to remember.
Easy day to remember. For some reason, it's burned into our heads here. April 15th, she does that. And then I would say around the 1st of June or so, she could go ahead and put some Kentucky bluegrass or whatever grass seed she wants to go ahead and put down there to help get that lawn established, and also do another reseeding in the fall of the year. And she's got to water. You've got to water your lawn. If you don't, it's not much of a purpose. I mean, why have a lawn if you're not going to take care of it? I'm sorry to be critical, but you don't have to baby it.
That's why I cut out all my sod, because I was like, I'm not going to deal with this.
Well, that's the way to do it, yeah. Just let nature take its course. But, you know, I've visited several sites, several homes where people have really horrible-looking lawns, and they wonder why. And I say, well, when was the last time you watered? Oh, I never watered a lawn. Okay, well, I'm sorry, but that has to be something. You might ask why you're way underweight. Well, when was the last time you ate? Oh, I don't like to eat. Well, that's the same basic thing there. So,
well, I don't have that problem.
I don't either.
888-755-6377, or you can email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We do have an email about a patch of Queen Anne raspberries. They are in the third year of production and harvest here. In the first harvest year, there was excellent yield. Second year, there was really only an area in the center of the patch, and the yield was good. And then this year, you can about guess what's going on now. So what do you think?
Well, it sounds like from her description that she might have the picnic beetle working on her raspberries. Now, it's the beetle that you don't want to invite to a picnic, but they're very, very small beetles that get into the raspberries as they're starting to ripen, and they kind of work on it, and then you go to pick them, and they kind of fall apart in your hands.
Yeah.
It's very tough to do. I don't know what kind of care she's given them, but basically you should cut your raspberry, your blooming canes back as soon as they're done bearing fruit every year. Dispose of them, burn them, get rid of them, take them to the dump, whatever, but don't leave them there. And then pick your raspberries as they start to ripen. As they're ripened, get them off. Don't let them become overripe. And follow good, scrupulous care as far as, general raspberry culture goes. Keep them clean. You don't have to spray them. If you have anything there that's showing disease or bad insect problems like cane borers, get them out of there, dispose of them. Raspberries are weeds, in a sense, weeds, W-E-E-D-S, in a sense, that you wouldn't want them if they didn't bear such delicious, healthy fruit. So the way to have them continue to bear fruit is to, take good care of them, pick them when they're ready to be picked, get rid of the old canes after they're done bearing, look for picnic beetles. If you see picnic beetles on a particular...
What does a picnic beetle look like?
Oh, my gosh. It's like a typical beetle, but they're so small, you don't see them until you pick a raspberry and say, what's the matter with this thing? And you see these little dots, little black dots.
So it doesn't have a little checkered tablecloth with
right.
it or anything like that.
Some wine.
A sense of humor. 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay,
888-755-6377 is the number to call. There's about 15 minutes left in this live broadcast where you can get a hold of Ron. And we do have a caller, James in Moorhead.
Hi, James. Welcome.
Yes, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a bunch of cannas, not to be confused with cannabis, but cannas flowers that I've grown for many years that they reach about 8 foot tall. The leaves are about 18 inches wide and 24 inches to 30 inches long. Now, what is the best fall way to pick them up, I guess, for the next season?
Are you saying
many different stories?
C-A-N-N-A-S?
I believe so.
Okay, they're white flowers?
No, they're red flowers. You usually only see them about 3 feet tall.
Yeah, and yours are 8 feet tall.
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to make sure I heard that correctly.
I've never seen. What are you feeding them?
Yeah. Well, they definitely are not winter hardy.
Mushroom mulch.
Okay, mushroom mulch. Okay, that would be excellent. Excuse me. You have them outside or inside?
Outside. Mm-hmm. They always have to have lots of water, lots of sun.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I usually dig them up, and every year I get more and more bulbs because they reproduce, and I just hand them out to the neighbors.
No, okay. You're a very popular guy then in that neighborhood. Have you been touched with the frost yet?
One day.
One day. Okay. How did they respond?
Just fine.
Okay. I would say you're kind of walking the tightrope right now as far as they go. They're not a hardy plant. They aren't even marginally hardy. So I would say dig them up carefully, put them in the garage or some kind of a semi-protected area where they are not going to be hit by a frost, and then let them dry down, cut the dried stems off, and then put them in storage somewhere, basically just a plain grocery bag, paper bag, and then sprinkle them a little bit of sulfur dust. That'll cut down on any possible diseases or insect activity that would be there for the during their storage period, and then of course set them out. I don't need to give you advice. So you should be giving me advice.
Yes.
You know, if you can grow 8 foot tall cannas, that's incredible. So, but basically, that's the way I would approach handling them.
Okay, wonderful, great. I'm just making sure I'm doing it all correct. One other question: I got a great big garden, and I can't get rid of my raspberries. I know the previous caller wants to preserve theirs. I want to get them out of my garden permanently without damaging my rhubarb. And just wondering if you can help me, because they are a weed.
Yes, they are. I went through the same thing. We fell in love with raspberries for a while, and then I just got tired of wrestling with them. And you have to be persistent. Dig those things out by hand with good gardening gloves, get them out, and you're going to have some more coming up no matter what, how hard you work. It's going to probably take about a 2, possibly 3-year process to get every last little rhizome out. If you leave a 1-inch rhizome in there, it's going to take off and grow for you. So hand digging is the only way I know, unless you want to go ahead and do some spraying, but you don't sound like the kind of a guy that wants to do any spraying.
Not exactly, no.
Okay, no.
Okay, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Appreciate thank it. You for your call.
Well, thank you, James. Appreciate it. We have a call from Mark in Tolley.
Hi, Mark.
Yes, howdy. I got two important questions for you.
Okay.
Okay, one is about asparagus seeds. While wild asparagus plants, I forgot to pick them into seed. So I harvested a bunch of them seeds. Some are dried out. Some are red berries yet. Is there any... Do you have any knowledge of luck of growing these seeds in a garden?
Well,
next year.
Yes, they will grow for you next year. If you can go ahead and put them in the ground now, it's not going to hurt them to be put into the soil, and they will sprout and grow for you. The ones that are viable that haven't overly dried, if they're viable seeds, they will sprout and grow, and you'll have these little small asparagus ferns coming up next spring. But you're not going to get the asparagus shoots that you want for about 3 or 4 years. It's going to take time to do that. What I would suggest doing, once you identify the asparagus ferns that you want, dig those out, plant them where you want them to be in full sun, good drainage, well-nourished soil, and then stand back and give yourself a couple of years to go ahead, and you'll have a nice asparagus crop.
Interesting. Thank you. One more question.
Sure.
There's a bunch of new tree seedlings growing up in my garden spot. About 5 years ago, I dumped on a whole bunch of wood chips, and I've been getting new seedling trees coming up, and some of them are about 6 to 8 inches tall, that's all. Is it too late to transplant them?
No, it's actually perfect time. They should be changing leaf color now by now, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. I would wait until they go completely dormant. I'd tag the ones that you want to transplant so you don't get them confused when they're all little bare sticks, and then carefully dig them up. That's the perfect size to go ahead and dig them and plant them where you want them. Protect them from the rabbits this winter. put a cage of chicken wire over them, and you'll do very well.
Should I cover them up with straw or anything?
Straw only attracts rodents, and I won't say only attracts. It would be a protectant, but if you're a rodent, you're going to be looking for a nice little bit of straw to go ahead and nestle down in. And if you go in there as a nice home and say, oh, look, he provided a meal for me, seedling maple. So simply go ahead and I'd put a cage over them. A chicken wire cage would work just fine to keep the rabbits away.
Great. Thank you much.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Thanks for the call, Mark. And if you have a call, just give it to us right now, 888-755-6377. The question line is that number, and the horticulturist is in. We'll be back with Main Street in just a moment.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. First, you can always contribute to Prairie Public at 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. That said, now, thank you, from all of us at Prairie Public, to the people who have contributed money to support the operation. You are keeping the news, the music, and all going. Over the last few days, we had our fall membership drive, and we received phone and web pledges from over 250 people, exceeding the goal. Longtime listeners will have noticed that the drives are shorter than ever. That's thanks to people who have signed up to be monthly sustainers, as well as people simply responding more quickly. Without your support, we would not be here. So again, to you, our listeners, thank you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and horticulturist Ron Smith. We're taking your questions, and of course, we're also thanking those of you, just like Bill just did, who, you know, contributed to our membership drive, which ended this morning. I know Ashley was on the air till 9 this morning, and we met our goal. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Congratulations.
It is wonderful. Thank you so much to everyone who contributed. Ron, this is kind of a good time of year just in general to talk about lawn care and what are some pre-W-word things that we should be doing to our lawns.
Right now we're getting a lot of leaf drop, of course, as everybody notices, and it's a good idea, as much as most people don't like it, to kind of keep the leaves off the grass. You can, if you have a light covering, you can take and run your mower over it, and with a mulching blade, it'll cut the leaves up into little confetti-like pieces and blow it right back into the canopy of the turf. If you have a pile of leaves, then you should really pick them up with a vacuum bag attached, a leaf bag attached, and get the grass exposed to as much sunlight as it can, because this is the time of the year that the grass is growing in an assimilative way, not in a surging way. So the assimilation is taking in the sunlight energy, taking the carbohydrates that it makes from that through its chlorophyll, storing it in the crown and the root system, so it'll come back looking beautiful and vigorous for you next year. So if you have them covered with a lot of leaves, the grass is not going to be able to do that. So that's a good thing to go ahead and do. The other thing, if you have a thin lawn, it's a good idea to go and get what we call dormant seeding or thin spots. Put some grass seed down, kind of cover it up with a little bit of soil, just a very little bit, just about a quarter of an inch of soil. Get it incorporated into the bare spot. If you're not going to add any soil, scratch that bare spot up or the bare spots up. Put the grass seed down. It's not going to come up now. It's not going to make it. But it'll go through what's called a priming process, and it'll pop and grow for you next spring.
You're talking about getting leaves off of grass. Mm-hmm. Does that same thing apply to a garden bed? Because I'm a little confused, because a lot of times they talk about putting compost down on the garden bed, and the compost, there's a lot of leaves in there a lot of times. So is that, are those the same types of leaves, or is there something substantially different about putting compost down, or just you don't have to worry about raking out a garden bed?
No, if you have an extensive garden, like one of the callers said that they have a big garden, and if you have leaves on your lawn, get the leaves off your lawn, put it on your garden, and then try to incorporate those with a fall rototillering, or just let them sit there through the winter, because they'll break down gradually a little bit and then till them in the following spring. So You got it. Wait, got it made.
All right. Well, here is another lawn question. Mm-hmm. And this one is, I overseeded my lawn using a good Kentucky bluegrass blend. Mm-hmm. I fertilized the last week of August and watered well before seeding on September 6th. Mm. I watered religiously after seeding. I was expecting to at least see some of the perennial ryegrass within 10 days. It's now 3 weeks. I've seen nothing. Mm. I went over the lawn in three directions, so I know there is sufficient seed there. Any ideas what I did wrong? Do you think the seed will come up, or did I just waste $100?
Ooh, I'm still watering it, he says also. Mm-hmm. Well, the grass should have sprouted and grown, especially perennial rye. Generally, you start to see perennial rye making some show there about a week to 10 days at the longest after they've been put down and given ample water. The only thing I'm afraid of is that there was a chemical on there, like a weed killer that he had applied on his lawn to control broadleaf weeds or grassy weeds like annual barnyard grass or crabgrass, that would be inhibiting that grass seed from germinating. Certainly, it should have germinated by now, or else the grass seed wasn't any good, and which would be a very, very rare thing. If you spend $100 on seed, that's a lot of seed to buy for $100. All I can tell him to do is if he can get a sample of that seed and have it tested at the local university, or he can do it himself, get a little flower pot, sprinkle some seed in that flower pot, moisten it with a spray of water, cover it with a clear plastic cover to keep it the humidity high. See if it sprouts in a few days. If it doesn't sprout in a few days, then the seed's no good for some reason.
He did say he overseeded. So is it possible that the seed just didn't get to the dirt?
Well, yeah. If he didn't work it into the soil, basically, if you're going to overseed your lawn, you should initiate that overseeding process with a power raking first to get the grass or the soil surface scratched up a little bit, and then put the seed down because that'll get the seed give the seed a place to embed itself in that loosened up soil, and then you should see some growth coming back. Mm-hmm. And it works. I mean, it's worked for me, I would say, 98.9% of the time that I've done it. Nothing is ever 100%, but, it sounds like he might even be overwatering, too. I mean, that could be a problem. You're keeping it too saturated.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. The horticulturist is in.
One more quick question here before you do have to go. There is an email that says, a few days ago, I had to remove my bleeding heart roots in preparation for building a wooden planter. Mm. How long can these roots remain out of the ground?
As short as possible a time. If she's going to leave them out of the ground, I would go ahead and get potting soil or some sphagnum. Unmilled sphagnum peat moss, dampen it, and get the roots covered up until she can get them to the ground. So you don't want those roots to dehydrate. So very, very, very important.
I would assume that applies to pretty much any root. Yeah. I mean, that's nothing specific to bleeding hearts at all.
No.
You know, dig it up,
you're going to
get them back
move in. Something, if you're going to plant this particular plant from point A to point B, mm-hmm. have the hole already open for point A plants to be moved into point B. Very simple.
If you're transplanting, is it any big deal if you move it twice? If I moved a plant and then I thought, oh, I wish I would have just put it 3 more feet over.
No, it's no big deal.
No big deal? Okay.
You don't need to blush, actually.
Okay. Well, if you have a question for horticulturist Ron Smith, you can always ask it.
Yes, you can reach us anytime via email, mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
They can come after me. Which they do sometimes, at toughtruck1@gmail.com.
All right. toughtruck1 mm-hmm. @gmail.com. Mm-hmm. Coming up on Main Street, Tom Eason will have a Plains Folk essay. Chef Rosie will talk about a Vietnamese staple called pho. And we'll have our What's Happening calendar of events. Now, though, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Water Commission's section chief for the Northwest Area Water Supply Project says he believes NAWS has a strong case to make a fight to an appeal. NAWS would bring Missouri River water to Minot and other parts of Northwest North Dakota. Manitoba and Missouri sued in federal court to stop the project. Manitoba is concerned about biota transfer from the Missouri River system, while Missouri had a concern over who has the right to Missouri River water. A judge in D.C. found the project would be allowable and met environmental standards. The two governments appealed on the last possible day. Tim Frege is the NAWS section chief.
You know, the merits of the case have already been heard repeatedly, been heard a few times. And the opinion written by Judge Collier that came out August 10th, we feel, sets us up very strongly for defense against an appeal.
Frege says the project has been delayed for 12 years and further delays could be problematic. Frege says the issues on appeal are yet to be laid out, and he expects to see them in a few weeks. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says there's no reason to stop the construction of flood control structures around Oxbow. A federal judge in Minnesota has ordered a halt to some parts of the FM flood control and diversion project because the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources hasn't issued permits for the project. Some upstream opponents have said all construction should stop until some agreement is worked out and the Minnesota DNR issues the permits. But Mahoney says
construction in Oxbow had already been mediation, had been already decided by the same judge. And so we, the feeling, and the DNR also agreed with it that they could finish what they had been authorized to do before. I think there's heartburn. The upstream people think they shouldn't be able to do that, but they still need flood protection. So the part that they're building is really only around Oxbow. It's smart use of money, smart use of time. They're already doing it right now. If they slow it down, of course, then you're delaying your construction until next spring.
Mahoney told a joint meeting of the State Water Commission and the legislature's Interim Water Topics Committee he's got his fingers crossed that the task force set up by the governors of Minnesota and North Dakota will come to an agreement and the diversion project will move forward. And Luke Hagness of Castleton says it was the thrill of his lifetime. A hunter since he was 13, he was bow hunting east of Lake Bronson, Minnesota, when he got a bear. You could call it a trophy.
Well, it's definitely a record in my book. But, you know, the rough scale we weighed it was 456 pounds. I haven't had the skull measured yet to see if it'll make Boone and Crockett or not. Pretty positive it'll make the Polk and Young record books, but I never expected to get one that big. The average bear in Minnesota is probably, you know, 150 to 200 pounds.
Hagness, on the fourth day of a five-day bow hunt arranged by Bear Busters Outfitters of Carlstead, had been on a ladder stand for 5 hours, and it was nearly dark when the big bear wandered out and was about 25 yards away when he got his shot. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a student of history, has been for most of his life, and he's also a distinguished professor of that discipline at North Dakota State University and the man who writes the Plains Folk essays and voices them for us right here on Main Street. Today, his essay is titled Dry Bones.
Those of an Old Testament frame of mind will find resonance in my title today, Dry Bones. But in fact, I speak not from the book of Ezekiel, but rather from the historical sources of the Northern Plains in the late 19th century. Last week, I talked about a great pile of buffalo skulls photographed at Detroit's Michigan Carbon Works, where bison bones were burned into bone black for making sugar and fertilizing farms. Now I follow those bones back to their point of origin on the prairies, specifically to the Dakota Territory. We know from pioneer memoirs, local histories, and brief mentions by academic historians about the bone trade, how bone pickers fanned out across the prairies, retrieved the dry bones of otherwise vanished herds, and delivered them in trade to the railroad towns. Now, getting into pioneer newspapers chronicling the trade, I am able to correct some misapprehensions and delve into details. In the first place, pioneer memories notwithstanding, the bone trade was not dominated by homesteaders making a little cash to grubstake their claims. Homesteaders mostly retrieved the remnants not already gathered by previous pickers, individuals who set out in wagons as soon as railroad towns were established in any particular place. The early bone pickers in North Dakota comprised two groups: transient whites who followed the railroad frontier, and reservation Indians, along with mixed bloods, or Métis. Turtle Mountain Chippewa and Spirit Lake Dakota were prominent participants in the trade.
Note the locations of those two reservations, and we become attuned to another insight from the primary sources. I suspect we are conditioned by experience with Theodore Roosevelt National Park to think of the country west of the Missouri as the Buffalo Range. But the Missouri Coteau and adjacent Drift Prairie were prime buffalo country, and thus prime bone-picking country. Cooperstown, for instance, was a center for the trade. On May 30th of 1884, the Cooperstown Courier reported 250 tons of bones, representing at least 10,000 animals, they said, awaiting shipment to the Carbon Works in Detroit. The going price paid to pickers was $8 a ton. Beginning in 1885, every issue of the Courier carried ads like, "Wanted, 2,000 tons of buffalo bones at Widen Brothers. $12 per ton for buffalo bones at John Siverson and Company. Cash paid, flour or merchandise exchanged for buffalo bones. Cash paid for dry buffalo bones at Widen Brothers." Now, there you heard that phrase, dry bones. And here is the explanation I discovered. I am quoting a Jamestown paper in 1890. "A Kidder County man who gathers buffalo bones for the market is said to let them soak overnight in water before delivery. The weight is materially increased thereby." Now, I'm not saying that it was common for bone pickers to work this waterlogging scam, but purchasers advertising for dry bones were warning them not to expect premium prices for bones quickly gathered after a good rain.
That's Tom Ezard. Pretty interesting anecdote there. Coming up on Main Street, Chef Rosie talks about one of the world's great soups.
Support is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
And he replied, "The Infomorph isn't taking your identity. It is repurposing social media data into an infomorphic aesthetic."
Join us for more true stories told live. This time, who am I really? Stories of questioned identity. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. It's time to talk about food, and we're going overseas and around the world today.
We are going to talk about pho. I'm not sure if you can tell from my voice, but I am just getting over a little bit of a cold. And I was talking to Rosie because pho is one of those things that it's the only good thing about being sick is to eat a good brothy food. So set us up here, Rosie. What is pho?
You know, just so that for a point of clarification, in fact that we are in the Midwest and pho is not as popular here as in other parts of the world, but there are a lot of people that will probably better understand what we're talking about if we say pho, P-H-O.
Okay.
Totally the wrong pronunciation, but maybe that will help some people understand the restaurants they've had it in, but it is pho. What is pho? Well, pho is a Vietnamese soup, but one point of very interesting numbers is the fact that more pho is eaten in a day around the world than all of the other soups combined. So here it is, soup that most of you listening are saying, what in the Sam Hill are they talking about? And then I tell you that it's eaten more commonly than all the rest of the soups combined. Because it's a breakfast, it's a lunch, it's a dinner, it's a late night. It's a soup that it's good for the soul, and in parts of the world they eat it every single day. We love our tomatoes, cream of tomato soup, and our chicken noodle soup, and our chicken and dumpling, but we don't have them every single day like the people that have pho.
I would put chicken pho up against any chicken noodle soup I've ever had. It's really good.
Yeah, and it is. You know, pho is a rice noodle. Pho is a broth with rice noodles in it. And it used to be in the beginning back in 1858 when it was brought to Vietnam. There was a couple of different types of pho, the northern Vietnam and the southern. But they used to make it, the noodles were, when they had rice left over in their restaurant, they would puree that rice and put it through a machine and make rice noodles. Hence, we had the pho, which is the noodle of the soup. And it's almost always made with either chicken or beef, even though it was much more popular for hundreds, if not thousands of years, to eat pork or shrimp. in those Asian countries. But now pho has come along, and it's chicken and beef, which is very unusual because they didn't eat much of that because they didn't have a lot of cattle. Chicken, yes, but cattle was almost unheard of. And when I think of making pho, I think of all the times I've made it and all the restaurants that I've had it in, and some say Vietnam and some say Thailand and some say other Asian countries. There are some common ingredients that I've never had pho that didn't have it in it. And those common ingredients, it's almost always with a chicken or a beef broth. It almost always has cilantro and scallions in it. It almost always has ginger and bean sprouts in it. It almost always has cilantro in it. And it almost always, you know, it's funny because every single one of these ingredients I'm saying I have every time. It's usually Thai basil, but in this country we use whatever basil we can find. And then fresh lime juice and hoisin and chili garlic sauce.
That's exactly what I was going to say was in the pho that I have been eating pretty regularly during this call.
But you didn't mention the star anise.
I didn't. Star anise is one that I don't think of that because that's a background ingredient, but it's a very powerful ingredient, and I use it, and I did skip it here. But it is an important ingredient, and I'm not sure if I said also fish sauce. Fish sauce is really hard for us here in the Midwest, or basically Americans, to use, because if you ever open a bottle of fish sauce and put your nose to it, you would say, why in God's name would I put that in anything that I'm going to love? Because you will love pho. And you will – I've never come across anybody that didn't say, wow, that's an amazing soup. But fish sauce, which is a fermented fish sauce, by itself is more than powerful. It's very polarizing. It's very – I don't think anybody puts fish sauce up to their nose and goes, wow, that smells really good, and then wants to take a couple of slugs off the bottle, because it is a very polarizing flavor. But as a background flavor in pho, it's a very important flavor as well.
You don't want to know how it's made, actually, but it's a very important ingredient.
Yeah, I know. I have it in my refrigerator, and I think most people that have it in their refrigerator, a bottle lasts
a long time.
Maybe it's one of the things you can tell your kids, of all the things in my refrigerator, the one that I'm leaving to you, because it'll probably still be here, is the fish sauce.
It goes a long way.
Is pho as easy to make as it sounds?
Well, of course, we're starting with this broth. And if you don't know how to make a good beef broth or a chicken broth, that's the base of the soup. And we're pretty good at making chicken broth or stock, call it what you want, bouillon, broth, stock, all the same, derivative of cooking down bones with vegetables. If you know how to do that, that's a good – if you've got that as a good starter, that's good. Now, beef broth, that's a whole different topic because beef bones – cattle are a little bigger than chickens. The bones are a little bit larger, and they have to cook for 12 to 24 hours. But – I want to preface that by saying you can buy amazing chicken and beef base now in your local supermarket. Word of advice, though, when you buy chicken or beef base, buy it in the refrigerated section of the store and look for the ingredient, the first ingredient to be chicken for chicken base and beef for beef base. If it's sodium and sodium nitrate and MSG and powder, and you can leave it on the shelf for the rest of your life and it doesn't go bad, that's not the base you want to use when you make your next batch of pho, because there are some really good bases out there now.
How long should it take to make it?
Once you have the broth, we're talking 5 minutes. There's nothing in there. None of these vegetables that I named, the scallions or the ginger, the bean sprouts, all of them go in raw.
Yeah, I've never had it where I didn't assemble it myself.
Nothing has to simmer. All of those vegetables go in and they soften in the hot broth. And sometimes, like in different types of cooking, they'll actually have a little, like a sterno underneath it, so it continues to keep it warm. But all of those ingredients are added cold. And even the beef in pho, in a beef pho, is usually added either raw or rare.
Because it's very thinly sliced.
Yeah, exactly, very thin. Now, of course, that's not the same. So you don't do that with chicken. The chicken is cooked and sliced paper thin as well.
And that's why it makes sense that these street vendors in Southeast Asia are selling it, because they got the broth going all day and they just make it fresh?
Yeah, and it gets better and better and better because they're constantly adding chicken bones to it and adding things to it so that the broth is getting stronger and stronger and more intense. And that's pretty much – if you have pho at your favorite Asian Vietnamese restaurant, the broth is the first thing you taste, because if we add all of those other wonderful fresh ingredients, if we start with a broth that tastes like dishwater, we're not going to get very far. And I'm sorry to use that analogy, but a bad broth is never going to make a good pho.
You know, the last time I ordered some, I was surprised to get a fork with my order. I always thought it was a chopstick and spoon kind of thing.
Well, it is. In fact, there's many articles and videos and books written on how to eat pho. And you can't eat it with just chopsticks because there's broth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually eaten with an Asian spoon and chopstick. But in case you didn't realize this, when I take a lot of my friends to restaurants that have chopsticks, the first thing they say is, and don't forget to bring me a fork, because they don't know how to use chopsticks. But yes, traditionally it's chopsticks and an Asian spoon, soup spoon.
And the Thai people like to use forks, so different strokes,
I guess. Is that right?
Yeah.
See, that's news to me. And there's a very famous French beef Burgundian stew called pot-au-feu that's been around since the Escoffier and the Karim days of cuisine. And that pot-au-feu is considered to be possibly one of the beginnings of where pho came from in Asia, in Vietnam. They say the French may have brought it because they were using beef long before they were in Asia. And pot-au-feu is, in classical French restaurants, you find it all the time.
Well, now it's coming back our way, and it's a delicious treat, pho. Well, if you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public.
What's happening is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week I chat with Reem Cassis, a Jerusalem-born writer and author of The Palestinian Table, a gastronomic journey across Palestine. We travel to India, where our reporter tastes camel's milk, which turns out to be more medicine than food. And J. Kenji Lopez-Alt weighs in on the science of how to cook beans. That's coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
He's singing what we're thinking. What is going on this autumn weekend around our area? Well, a fair amount, because, of course, we got a special day tomorrow.
With Friday the 13th, yes, and, of course, the month that is also including Halloween, we get a great number of sort of spooky-themed events. And so let's start with one of those, Miss J's Friday Night Frights Indie Horror Double feature this Friday the 13th in Grand Forks at the Fire Hall Theater. And so this is a perfect pairing of indie horror classics. First up, She Was So Pretty, a quirky slasher gem. And then they're going to follow that up with The Barn. And this sort of pays homage to the great B horror movies of the 1980s. This gets going at 9 p.m. Friday, October 13th in Grand Forks at the Fire Hall Theater, and it is just $10 to go see two movies.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show is Friday in Minot at the Vegas Motel. Come out and celebrate one of the spookiest days of the year with the Magic City Misfits, who are putting on a shadow cast presentation of the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the Vegas Motel Ballroom. There'll be a bar for those over 21. Audience members are encouraged to come out in costume, be it as your favorite Rocky Horror character or what you'd be putting on for Halloween. It's 9 o'clock on Friday the 13th. It costs $15 to get into the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the Vegas Motel in Minot.
Dracula this Friday through Sunday the 13th through the 15th in Belfield at the Belfield Theater and Performance Center. This is, well, has elements of dark chills, surprise thrills, and even some laugh-out-loud moments. Dracula the comedy, huh? It will stir your blood. It is 7 p.m. Friday through Sunday, October 13th through the 15th at the Belfield Theater and Performance Center. Tickets are $10 to $20.
All right. Well, here's Frankenstein Live. It's not on October 13th. It's not on Friday. It's Tuesday, October 17th in Fargo at the Fargo Theater. This is great. The 1931 classic Frankenstein film, of course, starring Boris Karloff, will be accompanied with a score performed live by the Concordia Orchestra. This new score, written by contemporary composer Michael Shapiro, captures the essence of the historic film with a fresh and modern twist. It's 7:30 Tuesday, October 17th at the Fargo Theater. $10 in general admission and $7 for students.
Spanish Song and Dance is Sunday the 15th in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. It is, after all, National Hispanic Heritage Month, and so all of these songs and rhythms, they will all be in Spanish, 2 p.m. on Sunday the 15th in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. And it's free.
Well, Clue the Musical runs this evening through Sunday in Bismarck at the Dakota Stage. After two sold-out performances last weekend, tickets for these final performances are going fast. Was it Miss Scarlet in the billiards room with the rope, or perhaps Colonel Mustard in the kitchen with the knife? The audience gets to help solve the mystery. Who killed Mr. Body in what room and with what weapon? Thursday through Sunday evening, or Saturday evening performances at 7:30. There will be a Sunday matinee at 2 o'clock. It's $26 to see Clue the Musical at the Dakota Stage in Bismarck.
There's going to be a bluegrass jam Saturday the 14th in Valley City at the Barnes County Museum. This is from 1 to 5 p.m. Again, the Barnes County Museum. This is an acoustic-only jam. It's free of charge. Welcome to anybody who wants to bring an instrument. Doesn't matter the level of your musicianship. Saturday, October 14th in Valley City, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Barnes County Museum, and it's free.
Poetry on the High Plains is Friday and Saturday in Kildare at the High Plains Cultural Center. Who will remember what our region was like in the first half of the 21st century if we don't write down our stories, poems, and memories? That's the question asked by the literary nonprofit Dunn County Writers. We featured them on Main Street. This nonprofit group of 15 regional writers is hosting its fifth Visiting Writer Series on October 13th and 14th at the High Plains Cultural Center, again in Kildare. The hours for the October 13th reception and reading from 5:30 to 8, that's Mountain Time. And then October 14th, there will be a poetry workshop that runs from 11 till 1 in the afternoon, again, Mountain Time. The Friday event is free. The workshop is $10.
All right, here's my pick of the week, Owl Prowl, Friday the 13th in Upham at the J. Clark Saylor National Wildlife Refuge. You get to hear from a bird expert teaching you about owl ecology, and you even get cookies and cocos and crafts, and then you prowl for owls starting at 7:30. So the event starts at 7, prowling for owls at 7:30. It's free at the J. Clark Saylor National Wildlife Refuge.
1984, that's an important title. It's Thursday through Saturday this weekend through October 28th. And it's in Moorhead at Theater B's new home at 215 10th Street North. George Orwell's classic novel comes to life on stage in a timely and fast-paced adaptation by Michael Jean Sullivan. Orwell envisioned a dystopian near future where thought is a crime and the truth is constantly in flux. Imagine that. It's also a love story. Thursday through Saturday evening performances at 7:30 with Sunday matinees October 15th and 22nd at 2 in the afternoon. Adults $20, students $10 with a special discount for students on Thursday evening, that's tonight, for $5. And that's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 12th. Clarence lay in his life raft and knew he was going to die, and he was only 20 years old. Clarence Borley was born in Williston in 1925. By the time he was 17, the nation was embroiled in the Second World War. By the spring of 1942, Clarence signed up for the Navy Aviation Program, passed all his tests, and was sent off for flight training. He earned his wings and was picked to fly the Navy Hellcat fighter. By the spring of 1944, Borley was assigned to Fighter Squadron 15, stationed aboard the Navy carrier USS Essex. On June 19th,
1944, Clarence saw his first action in the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot. In the swirling, chaotic air fight, scores of Japanese planes were shot down. Borley was not able to fire a single shot. In all the excitement, Clarence had forgotten to charge his guns. On October 10th, Borley took off at dawn and headed for Okinawa. He was able to get behind a group of five Japanese Zeros, and this time his guns worked, and an enemy plane went down in flames. 2 days later, on this date, in 1944, Borley took off before dawn near the island of Formosa. As the sun rose, he became embroiled in an air battle. In quick succession, Clarence was able to shoot down four Japanese planes, making him one of the youngest aces in the Navy Air Force. Borley didn't have time to celebrate, for almost immediately his plane was hit by anti-aircraft fire. He crashed in the water, the impact breaking the Hellcat in two. A Japanese patrol boat came after him, but was driven away by other Hellcat fighters. One flew low over him and dropped a life raft, and Clarence climbed in. The second night in his life raft, he found himself in the middle of a typhoon, and all of his supplies were lost. By the fifth day, having no water, Clarence knew he was going to die. Suddenly, a large craft surfaced next to him. Unable to see very well through his sun-tortured eyes, he thought it was a Japanese submarine. He pulled his sidearm and prepared to fight it out when a man shouted to drop the weapon. The submarine was the USS Sawfish. Clarence Borley was rescued. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Actor Jackie Chan is known around the world for his comedic action movies, but he says he's had a hard time being seen as a dramatic actor.
They're just not used to it, to see Jackie slow motion on the beach kissing the girl. And I like to do that, but nobody hire me.
Jackie Chan's dramatic aspirations and his new film, The Foreigner, on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Just a moment left in today's show with Ashley Thornburg to thank those people who, you know, answered the call.
Yes, and that was during our member drive. We needed to hear from 250 people by the end of morning edition. Well, I was working morning edition this morning. We heard from 251. We ran that marathon and collapsed right at the finish line together. So thank you to everyone who said that this service is valuable and that you want to support this service. We thank you. We appreciate it. And we can't wait to start using that funding to continue to bring you the kind of programming that we frankly think you deserve.
Well, I'm going to be taking a break, actually, for a week or so. And
what,
Ashley,
we're allowed to do that?
Will be sitting in and hosting Main Street as she has in the past. And what do you have for tomorrow?
We are going to have a discussion tomorrow about the pros and cons of automation, when it's sometimes good for a workforce and when it has its downsides to a workforce. And we're going to learn especially about how that relates to the state of North Dakota and its workforce. And of course, Friday, we're going to also hear from Dave Thompson as he goes beyond the headlines and gives us some context and some analysis of the news. And Matt Olean reviews Blade Runner 2049 and Brad's status. That's coming up tomorrow.
And again, thank you all for helping support Main Street and Prairie Public. Enjoy the rest of your day.